Well, Mr. President and the General Secretary, I don't know what to say. Thank you very, very much for your welcome. And I'm very, very happy to have had the opportunity of coming here and taking part in the work in this country. It's difficult, you know, when you start on a job like this, as far as I'm concerned, to really believe that you're there. When the president of the lodge mentioned international president, I was kind of mentally looking round for Sri Ram. You see, I hardly feel that way yet. I still rather feel a bit of a baby president, if you understand what I mean, although perhaps not in size. Maybe you might say in more ways than one that the difference between myself and my predecessor was a question of quantity versus quality. Brother Sri Ram certainly had all the quality, and I got plenty of quantity. But, as you probably understand, it's a bit difficult starting off on a new job like this, and maybe that's why one feels one has to work rather hard and try and keep up, as it were, with all the things that come one's way and which one is invited to do. Because I feel really myself that we are at the beginning of something different and new. Of course, this has been said often enough, that in relation to the second centenary of our organization, it does seem to me that there is a lot of preparatory work that we should be doing. We have to begin and lay the foundations for what that new future is to be. It is a little bit like putting another story on a building which is already there. And if we're going to put another story on a building, we should be wise, I think. I look to the architects and builders in this room. We should be wise, I think, to look to our foundations and so on to see that they're able to support another story. Otherwise, we may come to grief. And this is, in my way of looking at it, a very good reason for us looking back to the beginnings of things and seeing, in fact, what it was like when our society was founded. We don't have to go back in the past to sort of live in the basement, as it were. No. But we do want to know, and I think rightly we should know, how things were, what happened, and why. And I believe myself that every member, whether he's an old member or a new one, should concern himself for some while at least with an understanding of the rather unusual beginnings with which this society was thrust into the world. Now, we don't make dogmas in this society, or we should not. Being human, we frequently do make them, or tend to, as a matter of fact. And this is one of our weaknesses, and perhaps one of the things which holds us back in relation to a lot of the inquirers who come our way. When they look at the objects of the society, they expect us all to be angels, and quite obviously we are not. But we don't have to disappoint all our inquiries, I feel, by being too dogmatic, as we sometimes are, about what we believe individually to be the truths of theosophy. Now, we have never made any dogmas about the existence of the masters. On the other hand, if you do read these early books, you cannot really deny that there were, together with and to some extent behind HPB and Colonel Olcott, a number of remarkable individuals whom we refer to in our literature either as masters or elder brethren or adepts or mahatmas or words of that kind. And they have told us, as HPB has also told us, that there comes at the end of every century a special effort on the part of the hierarchy to do something which will help mankind, to bring into man's orbit something new, something different, which will perhaps enable him to escape a little further from the foolishness in which we mostly live. And so there is an interest around the theosophical world, and I find people have this interest in lodges everywhere, in 1975 and what may happen. Now the first thing I feel that we have to face is, as far as I can see, a perfectly common sense fact. People say, shall we be involved in this new effort? And the answer must be, it depends upon us. Have we really done our job? Have we been sufficiently committed to this particular work? Or have we allowed ourselves to run away into all kinds of highways and byways, which are less important? If we have been committed, if we have done the work that was expected of us, it seems very reasonable and likely that we should be included in the new effort. But if we have not done our work properly, why should we be? Why? Can we put ourselves for a moment, or try, in the position of those who are setting out to bring into the world some new ideas? They will, presumably, look around for the channels through which these new ideas can be most adequately, forcefully, usefully expressed. If they look towards the Theosophical Society and find that we have become a little bogged down in our past and in our somewhat dogmatic tendencies, perhaps we shall be overlooked. They may look around and find some other group or some other people who they feel is going to do their particular job now better. Isn't that only common sense? So that the answer to the question, shall we be involved, must lie with us and what we are doing or not doing. Now, it is absurd to repeat, of course, that we live in a world of tremendous changes, and we can see these changes going on around us. But in our more limited theosophical group, so to speak, what are we in fact seeing today? Well, we are seeing in the world around us another group of people arising, as far as I can see. If our great brother Leadbeater was here, I should like very much to ask him, in relation to his books like Man Whence and Whither, whether we are seeing or have seen recently the advent to this world of ours of a new shipload, as he called them, of souls from the moon chain. That is to say, a group of egos who have not probably been in incarnation in this world much before now, because they had already advanced beyond, until now, beyond this stage of civilization that we have, but are only now coming back into a civilization where they can, as it were, benefit and go forward. Is that what we're witnessing? I wonder sometimes. The astrologers tell us that we're moving into a new age. We're going from Pisces into Aquarius. I don't know much about astrology. HPB said, you will remember, with regard to astrology, when asked whether it was an accurate science, she said, yes, astrology is accurate, but astrologers are not. And that's probably, to some extent, true. It doesn't mean that we should look down our noses at the astrologers. If astrology is accurate, then good luck to them. And may they discover more and more about it so that their prognostications and so on can become more accurate. What do they tell us? They tell us we're leaving a sign which was a watery sign, a sign of emotion. Water finds its own level. It isn't really a soaring sign. And moving into an airy sign, which has, technically speaking, no limits. A sign of tremendous expansion. A sign of great universality. A sign which is very, very different from what we had in the past. And they tell us that we are now moving, some say we have already, some say we haven't quite, moving into that. And isn't this exactly what is happening around us? Dr. Besant, C.W. Well, 70 years ago and more, were writing in many of their books about the coming of the sixth sub-race. And they even said that they saw evidence of it amongst the people of the world in those days. Isn't it reasonable to suppose that 70 years later there are far, far, far more of these people going about around us? Surely that's only common sense. We have tended to be conditioned, perhaps, in the end of the book, Man Whence and Whither, where C.W. Well mentions the founding of the sixth root race several hundred years hence. And so perhaps we vaguely think, oh yes, all this business is a way off in the future. I would like to suggest to you that the sub-race is not in the future. The sub-race is already here. It's here now. And what is more, it's come to stay. We're not going to get rid of all these new things that many of the young people want. They're going to do them because that's what they've come to do. They didn't come here to conform. They came here to bring something new. Surely we as students of theosophy have seen this happening through historical theosophical history, so to speak. It's exactly what happened when one race superseded another. And this is what is happening again. And yet you hear so many theosophists critical of all the things that many of the young people are doing. Now, I don't mean to say that all the young people are perfect. Of course they are not. You do get creatures here and there who are quite happy to kick someone to death just for fun. I'm not speaking of that kind of person. I'm speaking of the type of young person that you find all around the world today, who is basically an idealist, who's willing to suffer for his views, his ideals, who's got great courage, who's aware of world problems and concerned and active to try and do something about solving them. You meet these people all around the world today. You hear a lot about them in certain countries because, well, in America, for instance, because America's news everywhere. You meet such people in Argentina and you don't hear about them because Argentina is not news. But they're there, and they're there in every other country with the same idealism and responding in the same way to the same kind of things that young people in America or here, Australia, Europe, are responding to. Who are the people who most easily understand our brother Krishnamurti? It is just these people. My generation don't begin to understand him very deeply, although some think they do. But lots and lots of these young people do understand what he's talking about. They understand, even if they can't yet do it, what it means to free oneself from the imprisonment of one's own mind, which is basically what he's talking about. And many of us find that extremely difficult to do. So I can't help feeling myself that when we're looking for signs of what may be going to happen, we might just consider all this particular field. After all, 100 years ago, when the Theosophical Society was, going to be brought about, the whole thing started much earlier. Notably, of course, with the instructions given to HBB to go around the world and investigate all the religious rites and ceremonies and so on in the most out-of-the-way places in order to gather material for her books as a basis. So probably the new effort is not going to start on the 1st of January 1975. It's already begun long ago, if we have the eyes to see. And I'm not at all sure that this isn't one place we should look. I was going to say, the eyes of the young people. How often one hears criticisms of their clothes and criticisms of long hair, which is sometimes, I admit, not always as tidy as it might be. But look in the eyes. And there you have your answer nearly always. Don't let us be afraid. Let us begin to realize that the sixth subrace is already coming into being. We don't have to wait for it for hundreds of years. It's already here, in part at least. And we should be amongst those who are trying to recognize it and trying to do everything we can to help. But alas, in our society, as I said at the beginning, we are somehow pegged down by the past. And we're so keen to preserve and to protect the past that we're afraid to let go. We could have far, far more younger people in our lodges if we would allow them to do something that they want to do. But because it's different from what we have always done, we don't let them. And so naturally, as they've got some kind of courage and some kind of character, they go away. And often, alas, they go to someone else. And around us we have so many organizations which are basically not really as good as this. Not that I want to say that theosophy is the only thing, I don't. What I feel about theosophy is this, that we somehow have got a job to do in this very difficult transition period, for which perhaps in part we were founded as a society, to maintain the... Please don't think I'm being conceited in saying this, but so to speak, the life-giving waters, pure, cool, thirst-quenching, in the age in which everybody's rushing here and there after cocktails. And the cocktails give you a quick kick. You think you're getting somewhere, but they don't quench your thirst. Now, I think our job, somehow, is to maintain something which will be there in 500 years' time, when many of the cocktails of today will long since have been forgotten. So we've got a very real responsibility to preserve what is right and good and true whilst being open to all the new methods which belong to 1975. So I feel, therefore, that we have to begin, not to begin again, but to look once again at our beginnings and try to understand what was happening then. We speak of the adepts. HBB gave herself completely to the work, I think perhaps because she knew what an adept is. Now, I don't pretend to know what an adept is. I don't consider I'm able to know all that. But I think HBB did know. And today we have a view all over the world, even amongst rather nice people, that somehow the development of lesser powers, what are called lesser siddhis in the Sanskrit, psychic powers, even higher psychic powers, somehow that is going to lead to adeption. And I am not at all sure that that is how it works. I don't really believe that an adept becomes an adept by the development of psychic powers. It's the other way round. He becomes an adept by hard work. Sheer hard work, life after life after life. Doing what has been recommended to every student, to every disciple, to every would-be neophyte, all down the ages, in terms of paying attention to, for instance, discriminating in the right use of energy. And that must apply to us. How do we discriminate in the uses of our energy? Do we waste our energies on futile things, or do we try and use our energy for the things that matter? I suppose, life after life, that is what the adept has probably done. He's paid attention to all the rules that have been given for chelas and not departed from them. He has not suffered himself to be led aside into side tracks and cul-de-sacs. He's had his eye on the goal and gone on. If upon the rules he would find you must love, then he has loved. And that means everybody. And so on and so on. Surely it's in this way, through sheer hard work, that the adept finally becomes the adept, whatever that may mean in consciousness, which I personally, of course, don't know. And with the position, if you can call it the position, or the stage of consciousness that he reaches, there go certain powers. So that, of course, he has at his disposal all the psychic powers, should he care to use them. Many, perhaps, we don't even know of. But he doesn't reach that position by the development of those powers. And I feel that HBB knew it. And because of that sheer hard work involved in this real spiritual ladder climbing, as it were, she had this tremendous respect and reverence, as also Colonel Olcott, for the elder brothers who were assisting them to bring the society to birth. That's why, I suppose, they gave themselves whole and completely to the society. There was nothing they wouldn't do, there's nothing they wouldn't sacrifice. They didn't care about their comforts. They didn't even care about eating often enough at Adyar. They went hungry because they had to put the Theosophist into envelopes and send it all over the world. They didn't have time to eat. And often they didn't even have any money to buy food. They gave themselves completely to this work. And that is why the society exists. All that sacrifice, so to speak, brought us into being. Without it, we wouldn't be sitting here, perhaps. And so one must ask oneself, how much am I prepared to do? And what a different world it is, of course. Now one is fortunate enough to travel easily by aeroplane or by motor car or whatever it is. Colonel Olcott traveled often enough for thousands of miles in a bullock cart. HPB sold her ticket. Remember, she was going first class on one occasion. She sold that in order to help this poor woman who'd been tricked out of her ticket to get across to America. And she went steerage with the other poorest people on the ship. And we'd all like to think, I'm sure, that we would do the same. But she did it. She did it. And I suppose another thing which you must think of here is the attention to duty. You see, duty is a word which we don't care for much. It sounds a little bit as though we were forced to do something we didn't want to do. I don't believe that is the right interpretation of duty, but it's what we most of us assume it to be. But duty plays evidently a big part. And may I quote you two quotations from the adepts in which they speak of duty. First of all, from the Master K.H. My first duty is to my master. And duty, let me tell you, is for us stronger than any friendship or even love. As without this abiding principle, which is the indestructible cement that has held together for so many millenniums the scattered custodians of nature's grand secrets. Our brotherhood, nay, our doctrine itself, would have crumbled long ago into unrecognizable atoms. And the Master M, I am as I was, and as I was, I am and always shall be, the slave of my duty to the Lodge and to humanity. Not only taught to, but desirous of subordinating all preference for persons to my love for the human race. Well, if you don't misunderstand me, I have the kind of feeling that if that is the way that they're trying to go, basically, it's the way I want to go. I don't know whether you feel that. I think we have a tremendous opportunity and a tremendous responsibility. I believe that the society was founded purposely for these turbulent times, to open the door to a consciousness based on the oneness principle. And brotherhood is a manifestation of that oneness principle, and we concern ourselves very much with it. Our work is by no means done, as some people sometimes would like to tell us. We only have to look around the world for a moment, look in the newspaper any day, to see where brotherhood is set at naught still in so many places. We have plenty of work to do along the lines of the objects that we have, even though possibly they could be varied slightly if the membership as a whole would like to do that. Let us look again at a statement of Madame Blavatsky, because I think that some of these things, without using them, as I have been talking about, as big sticks to beat anyone with, I think some of these things are still of great, thank you, of great usefulness to us. We are not working, she says, merely that people may call themselves theosophists, but that the doctrine we cherish may affect and leaven the whole mind of this century. This can be accomplished by an earnest band of workers who work for no human reward and for no earthly recognition, but who, supported and sustained by a belief in that universal brotherhood of which our masters are a part, work steadily and faithfully in understanding, that means studying, and putting forth for consideration, that means making available, in every way we can think of, the doctrines of life and duty that have come down to us from time immemorial. Falter not so long as a few devoted ones will work to keep the nucleus existing. You are not directed to found and realize a universal brotherhood, but to form a nucleus for one. You will notice that in there she speaks of the doctrines of life and duty. Again, the word duty comes in. Now, I looked up in a dictionary not long ago under the heading nucleus what it says about it. And it all comes down to two different things, really, rather interestingly enough. A central mass about which matter is collected. The germ of a cell. A central part or thing round which others are collected. The kernel of an aggregate or mass. The central part of an ovule seed, a plant cell, and so on. There are certain botanical significances also. But basically, it is something round which other things are collected, and something through which some work is done. The nucleus in a plant, in a cell, would be a point of dynamic life, shall we say, within that cell. The nucleus is, from our point of view, might be considered as a channel through which life is flowing into the cell. It is a dynamic thing, and it is also something round which other things collect. Therefore, every lodge, surely, becomes a nucleus, a channel through which life has to flow. Every individual in his home or his office, a channel. The society in any country, a channel. The world society, a channel for the world. And as the life flows out, so it is intended to attract other people towards the center. It seems to be the twofold work that we are supposed to be doing. And HPB points this out in no uncertain terms. And it brings us, therefore, again to the consideration of what we ourselves are doing. How committed am I to this work? Have I done those necessary things to make myself, so to speak, a fit channel for whatever forces flow through our society? Brandon Blavatsky again is quite clear. Be what he may, once a student has abandoned the old and trodden highway of routine and entered upon the solitary path of independent thought, he is a theosophist. Have I done that? Have you done that? Can I say of myself, I can't ask you, but you have to do it yourselves. Can I say of myself that I have abandoned the old and trodden highway of routine? Am I still involved in my life, not only with physical, but with mental processes, which are way, way back, the result of the past, so that my mind is all cluttered and not really free to look? Have I abandoned all that routine? I don't know. Not sufficiently, I'm sure. Am I prepared to enter a solitary path of independent thought? Independent thought, yes. But how prepared am I for a solitary path? A path perhaps of complete loneliness in certain sense of the word. Because you have to follow your own way home. And it can never be the same as anyone else's. Part of the way you may go hand in hand. But there are occasions when you have to go alone. As Plotinus said, the flight of the alone to the alone. Am I prepared for that? Which means basically really to lose yourself, to lose all you think of as me, as I. Do you be prepared to sacrifice it entirely? I don't know. And that, says Madame Blavatsky, is a theosophist. Most of us are members of the Theosophical Society. It doesn't appear to be the same thing in her mind. Again, she says, if a man would follow in the steps of the Hermetic philosophers, he must prepare himself beforehand for martyrdom. He must give up personal pride and all selfish purpose and be ready for everlasting encounters with friends and foes. He must part once and for all with every remembrance of his earliest ideas on all and on everything. And when I read these sort of things, which were, I suppose, from the point of view of HPB, rather basic to the real way that she was trying to indicate to us, I just only feel what an awful long way there still is to go. But we have to be fairly assured, I think, if we're honest, that we are really trying to go and not just talking about it and hanging back from actually doing very much. In your hands, brother, says HPB, is placed in trust the welfare of the coming century. Perhaps HPB today might say the same thing to us, that in our hands today is placed the welfare of the coming century. We have this immense opportunity with so much behind us, so much to give. And are we really going out to do it? If you could put our work in one sentence, I would say the dharma of the Theosophical Society is to make theosophy available. If one way is not successful, then we have to find another way. And we can gain so much help by looking at the world we live in to see what ways are becoming acceptable to the people of this day, so that we must move into these particular fields. If more and more and more the world is coming to rely on audiovisual things for education purposes and so on, then we have to move in that direction. And it's no good saying, oh, you always give lectures. People will come to lectures, of course, some people. But I would imagine that less will come, unless you have a very, very excellent and special and rather remarkable person. We must, I think, be prepared to move out and do things which we've never done before. Try out new ideas which we have not tried before and see how they work. If they don't work, never mind. No harm done. We mustn't be afraid. Fearlessness is one of the great characteristics of a person who wishes to tread the path. He must be totally unafraid, with the knowledge that no one can do anything to him at all. As long as we are afraid of other people and what they think of us and what they can do to us, we won't get anywhere. No one can touch you except yourself. No one can do anything to you except yourself. People may laugh at you. They may tear your ideas to bits. They may beat you over the head, but they can't touch you. So what is there to be afraid of? So I think from this point of view, we have to try and look at our lodge, perhaps in a slightly different way. Let's look at the lodge as though the lodge was an individual. The lodge is an instrument through which work has to be done, just as an individual is an instrument through which work has to be done. And the point is the work. Of course we should have a good instrument, but when we've got it, then we have to work. I met a lodge in the United States some years ago, and the president of the lodge said to me, "We never get any new members." And I asked him, "Well, what do you do in your lodge?" "Well," he says, "we have a very beautiful building. It's rather far out of town, and people don't come there very easily. And really, as a matter of fact, we have nothing but business meetings. Because we have to discuss all the time how we're going to keep our building and paint it and pay the rent and all that kind of thing." So, of course, it was not surprising. A man might have a beautiful plow, and he goes down to the field in the morning and he notices that there's some screws are loose somewhere. So he goes back and fetches his tools and he screws up and tinkers with the plow for a while, and then it's lunchtime. So he goes back and has lunch and comes back again and he notices a few scratches on the plow, and unhappy about that, he goes back and fits the paint pot, spends the afternoon painting the plow. And it's true he has the most wonderful plow, but he hasn't done any ploughing. Now, sometimes we spend so much time on the lodge, so to speak, that the lodge is not, so to speak, put to work to do some ploughing. And if you've ever had anything to do with ploughing, it's pretty rough work. You're not always ploughing an easy, flat field. You're very often dealing with fields that are going up and down and full of stones and all kinds of things. The work of a lodge can often be very difficult. But if the lodge is to be a nucleus, then let it nucleate, whatever that word is. Let it nucleate. I think that the lodge could be looked at a little bit as though it was a sort of group disciple, you see. I think we could go into that. And many of the rules that apply to the one apply to the other also. If you look at the guru-chela relationship and attitude, perhaps we could fit the lodge also into that kind of picture. For instance, just as an individual who is performing his daily prayers or meditations or aspirations, whatever it may be, may open with some kind of dedication, so the lodge can open with a kind of a dedication. I personally think that every lodge could very well open its meetings with something which is going to be a focus whereby the members can dedicate that particular meeting and themselves at the meeting to the service of whatever you believe to be that which we are here to serve. If we have a beautiful song as we had this evening, that can be the occasion for self-dedication, or something on the piano, or the repetition of a mantra, like, for instance, O hidden life, vibrant in every atom. But if we're going to repeat something, we must mean what we're saying. Sometimes you hear people just repeating these things as though they were just pleased to get them over. What do you mean by vibrant in every atom when you say it? Does it mean anything or doesn't it? Does it mean, for instance, that everything in this room can be reduced to the atomic level? That every one of us, every light, every picture, the carpet, the book, the floor, the piano, the flowers, everything can be reduced to the homogeneous atomic level, so to speak, where there is only one. And that is what we are, and where we are, and what it's all about. So that in repeating those words, it should lead us into an experience. O hidden light shining in every creature, what does it mean? I don't know what it means to you, I know what it means to me. To me it seems that there is a light in everybody's heart. Everyone has a light in their heart. And all these lights, they've got to grow and grow and grow and grow until they join up with the lights next door and behind and in front, and you've only one huge light. I don't know whether you see what I mean. That's what it is. It can be. But sometimes we just say, O hidden light shining in every creature. No, it doesn't create anything. But we're not really making use of it. O hidden love embracing all in oneness, all in oneness. Everything you can think of. I have a funny and silly thought about that, to tell you the truth, coming from my youth when I lived in Austria. And I used to go swimming in the summer. And they have beautiful arrangements for swimming along the edge of the Danube. And in those days, at least, it was all very compartmentalized. There were changing rooms for men and changing rooms for women, and special places where you could sunbathe, either men or women, sometimes with clothes, sometimes without clothes, places where you would swim, other places where children would paddle, there's a place where you could park your bicycle, another place you could sit and have some coffee, and somewhere else where there was a restaurant, and then behind that there would be a playing field where you could kick a football about, so on. Endless little compartments with hedges in between, you know? Masses and masses of hedges with little things, you know? And I don't know, the very first time I ever heard this invocation of Dr. Besance was actually in Vienna. And it just crossed my mind at that moment, and I remember it ever since, that in that big, big, big bathing establishment, all the hedges went flat. All the hedges went flat. And there, all, everybody who was doing everything, no matter what they were doing, were all one. And that's how it is. Every house has walls. All those walls go. Every building has doors. All those doors go. There is only the one which embraces all. So you see, an invocation can be an occasion for a great experience, really, for us, if we will all try and enter into it. So I think that the use of such things is a good one. provided that everybody is taking it seriously. Now, what is said to be the attitude of the disciple? He should be listening. He should have readiness to do and to do. He should have humility. He should be concerned with self-initiated helpfulness, not waiting to be told, but seeing what has to be done and going to do it. Fearlessness. He doesn't have to be more clever, but more useful than his neighbor. I don't remember where this expression comes from any longer, but it's always struck me as being of immense valuable to all theosophists. Nothing that affects nothing affects the happiness of humanity can fail to be of consequence to those who are training themselves to be its servants. And who are the greatest servants of humanity? Who? The great elder brothers are the greatest servants of humanity. But I feel that we, at our level, wherever we happen to be, should be concerned with everything that affects humanity. That's why I think it is so important that we should know the world we're in. Try and see what's happening in it. And see thereby the opportunities which are open to us to try and make theosophy available. Well, as with life, so also with consciousness. A disciple's consciousness must be reaching up to a deepening experience of oneness through the guru to whom he devotes his life, perhaps, to Brahman or God beyond. Meditation leads into a world of oneness. But in the group, the consciousness of groupness, the consciousness of the lodge, knowing itself to be a lodge, also leads to the idea of oneness. So more and more, a trained group can fit into the Guru Chela pattern, so it seems to me. And this makes our individual and group responsibility very great. A point occurs here with regard to our individual responsibility to life, mentioned as one of the steps of the Noble Eightfold Path by the Lord Buddha. The right means of livelihood. How often do we consider this? Here I go back to our young people in many parts of the world. This is something which is discussed in the young theosophist camp again and again and again. The young people in many countries are concerned that they shall not go into any means of livelihood which they don't feel fits in with theosophical ideals. They won't go near any organization of any kind which has anything to do with armaments or producing anything which is going to be used in war. And as a very large number of them, as I'm sure you know, are vegetarians, they won't go into anything which, as it were, is profiting from the slaughter or cruelty to animals. And so, by their sheer idealism, they narrow down the field in which they can become active if they want to earn their living in life. Now, I believe that that is something which the real member amongst us has to consider. You don't have to be vegetarians in the Theosophical Society. And, of course, we can be soldiers if we wish to be. But I think that the right means of livelihood is something, nevertheless, that we consider, and it should mean something to us, so that we don't simply romp into any kind of job without thought. We're supposed to be people who use our minds, and I feel. So all these sort of things can be looked at from the lodge group level, you see. Because the lodge also has got to initiate and change. The lodge has got to be alive as the individual. The lodge has got to grow. The lodge has got to listen. The lodge has got to be ready to change. The lodge has got to have the courage to change, just as the disciple must. To seize its opportunities, to stand on its own feet, and do what it thinks is right to do in the changing conditions in which it finds itself. And I believe if that happens, then life at a group level will flow. And the channel, as it were, of that lodge will be far more efficacious in the place where it works. We've got to be prepared for great changes to come, I think, and we've got, therefore, to be very, very secure in our own relationships. I don't know whether you remember something which happened way back in 1907. Just, I don't expect you to remember it personally. But it was an occasion when Colonel Alcott was very sick, and a very remarkable member, woman, called Mrs. Murray Russock, was looking after him. And the story which she told us herself before the war, and she died just before the war, started when she herself was under a pine tree somewhere, I believe in Italy, wrestling with a problem which was very severe and real to her. And she evidently must have said, "Master, what am I going to do about this?" And shortly after that, she fell asleep. And when she woke up, she had some ideas which were helpful. She traveled out to India and was helping Colonel Alcott in what, of course, proved to be his last illness. And it was a time when there was much concern in the society and argument about the doings of one of the important members of the society. Some people thought that he was right to do what he was doing, and other people thought he wasn't. And there was a lot of discussion and rather severe differences of opinion. And Colonel Alcott was writing an article about this, which you will find in the February issue of The Theosophist in 1907, if you want to look it up. And he said to Mrs. Russock, who was sitting there taking this down, writing, "How on earth am I going to finish this article? I don't know how to finish it off." And a voice came out of the corner of the room and said, "I will finish it for you." And those elder brothers, known by the initials KH and M, came into the room. Mrs. Russock was so surprised she dropped her pencil on the floor. And the master, M, picked it up, put it in her hand and said, "Write." And so she wrote. And this is what he dictated, and you can read it. You can read it in The Theosophist if you like to look it up. But I think it has just as much meaning to us today as it ever had in the past, because it emphasizes that the Theosophical Society is an instrument, and that it is our job to keep that instrument pure, so to speak, by our own lives. Further, it emphasizes the usefulness, the uselessness, the fruitlessness of getting up against one another. Just as the master says at the end of the letter, "Are you not struggling and striving against yourselves?" And of course that's what we are doing when we argue. We're only fighting ourselves because of the one. Let those who believe in our existence and that we are behind the Theosophical movement, also that we shall continue to employ it as an agency for the uplifting of mankind, know that we are sometimes forced to employ imperfect instruments for our work because of the lack of perfect ones. Cease, therefore, from such turmoil and strife and from causing such disturbance in the unity of brotherhood and thus weakening its strength. Instead, work together in harmony to fit yourselves to be useful instruments to aid us instead of impeding our work. We who are behind the Theosophical movement are powerless sometimes to prevent the checks and disturbances that must unavoidably arise because of the karma of individual members. But you can aid us much by refusing to take part in such disturbances and by living true to the highest possible ideals of Theosophy. Should any event bring forth seeming injustice, have faith in the law that never fails to adjust matters. Cease rushing headlong into strife or taking part in dissensions. but hold together in brotherly love, since you are part of the great universal self. Are you not striving against yourselves? Are not your brother's sins your own? Peace and trust in us. So very, very fundamental is that instruction. And we should never forget it, I think. I think we must try and arrange for it to be published again, so that every one of us can read it again all around our theosophical world. Now, we are moving, as I say, into something new and different. And I want to take as an example of this, I don't know whether you'd call it a statement, an article perhaps I'd call it, which came from the pen of Miss Marie Poots. And she herself gave it to me. She'd had a lot of copies made, and she'd given them to a lot of people, I suppose. Now, Marie Poots was the head of the ES, the Esoteric School in the United States and the rest of the Americas, for very, very many years. She was a wonderful little lady about so high. Very small. She was born in Louisiana, where once the French occupied that part of the United States, and was brought up, I think, on, amongst other things, very strong black coffee. And she loved black coffee. But as she grew older and older, and she finally was about 93 when she died, and she still traveled with her little bag, the members began to say to themselves, oh, poor old Miss Pooch, you know, she's getting rather old. I'm sure all this coffee won't be good for her. And so they used to produce all kinds of concoctions which she hated. And she was known on more than one occasion, when she couldn't bear it any longer, to say, in good theosophical language, from the unreal lead me to the real. Anyway, this she gave me this, and I feel, although I hardly, to tell you the truth, I myself hardly quite understand some of the words she uses, but I'll give you the actual words. For a number of years, I have been sorely puzzled over the problem of right and wrong. Questions which I could not silence had been repeatedly forcing their way into my consciousness. Was there really anything like right and wrong? Had morality any place in the plan of the Logos for the universe? The agony of the questioning was all the greater because it came when my thought turned to those who have transcended humanity, for they seem to condone what the commandments given by some amongst themselves forbid men to do. It seemed even in some cases as if those whom they chose to admit to their ranks earned that privilege by apparent mistakes and wrongdoing. And we read of Christ blessing Mary the sinner and rebuking Martha, whose faithful work made it possible for Mary to sit at the feet of her Lord. Are then moral laws given to men solely for the purpose of keeping the little ones quiet? As my landmarks grew dim in the darkness, an overwhelming pity for the little ones filled my heart, and a grim determination to sacrifice all to help them, even my conscience, if necessary. But one day in meditation, light came. I heard within myself these words: when confronted with a moral problem, men still centered in the ego ask, is it right? But those who have transcended the ego consciousness ask, is it love? As the meaning of those words began to unfold, I saw how the higher vision no longer deals with moral problems in terms of right and wrong, but in terms of love and not love. The human moral code makes a horizontal division, the clean above and the unclean below. But the divine moral code makes a vertical division, the clean and the unclean on the love side, and the clean and the unclean on the not love side. On the love side, not only the beautiful spiritualized emotions that grace evolved humanity, but also, below the line, the primitive and untransmuted stages of those emotions, debauchery, profligacy, rape, theft, the love of the drunkard for his liquor, all in short that has in itself the element of love for something or someone outside, the yearning for union with the self without. On the not love side, we find not only pride, anger, hatred, condemnation, self-love, murder, but also spotless purity, too white to suffer the proximity of mud, and perchance deeds of heroic self-sacrifice, unworn by love, done only because it was right. And further than that, the not love may not go. And those who have reached that stage have to be swept into the current of love, which is the fulfilling of the law. And who dare say how many ages it may take, and how many lives of suffering and agony. Hence those who are already on the love side, however soiled their manifestation of that love may be, are on the more direct road to the highest. Their possibilities of rapid transmutation are greater, and those who know how quickly the sinner may become the saint have always blessed and absolved the Magdalene and the publican. In their sight, the immoral man who lives a life of kindness towards his fellow men is greater than the man of irreproachable conduct who looks down upon his brother with the cold eye of criticism and contempt. Not because they condone immorality, but because they know what flower of great price will soon grow out of the mud and send forth the fragrance of God's very love. And the people whom I knew began to classify themselves. Men and women who I had condemned were on the side of love after all. And others whom I had admired were on the other side, in spite of their splendid achievements, because of their lack of sympathy and understanding. And now I understand the parable of Mary and Martha, and I am at peace, for I believe I have caught a glimpse of the measuring standard of those who are more than men. And when confronted by the moral problems of daily life, I am humbly learning to ask, not is it right, but is it love? Now, I find that very beautiful. Difficult? Difficult, of course. But in it, to me, there is something which indicates a new way, a way into which we ourselves can go in our approach and our judgment of other people, if we have to judge them. Let us judge not in terms of right and wrong, but in terms of love. I believe we have to try to do that with understanding hearts. So, it's a matter of how hard we try. And you know, I've no doubt, the great renunciation of Dr. Besant, which to me is so magnificent. And I feel, very little hope of being able to do the same. Perhaps you have to be rather great in order to do that. But some of you may know it, and if not, you will not mind if I read to you again. I see that teachers and helpers are wanted in the visible and invisible worlds to instruct and aid humanity, and I offer myself to be evolved into such a teacher and helper at any cost of present or future suffering, in the swift breaking up of my lower nature, by any means which the masters in their wisdom deem to be the surest and the swiftest, no matter how repugnant those means may be to my undeveloped understanding. Along any roads, however stony and precipitous, which they may judge best for reaching the object in view, I give myself without reserve, seeking nothing, asking nothing, hoping nothing for the separated self, content to be in the light or in the dark, to be active or passive, to work or to wait, to speak or to be silent, to feel sorrow or joy. My only wish to be what they need as an instrument for their mighty work. Now, although, as I said at the beginning, I'm making really no dogmas, I don't want to do that. I still feel that we should all ask ourselves just how far we are prepared to offer ourselves. How far are we able to come out of time and the conditions and the values of time which play such a big part in our lives and try to get into the values of the eternal, which we talk about so much, and which often have nothing to do with what's happening immediately now. So that when we have a decision to make, we make it in terms of the eternal values, the values which are real, like the love, for instance. Just how far are we prepared to give ourselves and to commit ourselves to this work? Because it is in committing ourselves that the work will grow, as we know from the beginning that in the commitment of those early people, the society was founded. So, in to conclude, as time is getting on, I'm going to use some further words of Dr. Besant. I think they are very inspiring. And please don't clap. If you feel like clapping, I hope you won't clap. Just let's be silent. Let's be silent. The silence is so full of life, so full of blessing. My birthday greeting to you, brothers all the world over, is written from amidst the encircling Himalayas. But not a vestige of them is visible, thick shrouded as they are in earth clouds. Shall I then doubt that the mountains are there, that their green slopes, their mighty crags, their heaven-piercing peaks of snow are but dreams, imagination fashioned? Nay, verily, for I have seen them, I have trodden them, and I know. With equal certainty, with equal surety, I know the unshakable truths of the ancient wisdom, of the hierarchy who guides, the world teacher who inspires, the embodied will that rules. The Himalayas may crumble, but these abide in the eternal. I see the star that shines over the White Island. Lift up your eyes, my brothers, and you too shall see it. Then face fearlessly the raging of the storm.